Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, August 9th, 2011, and I'm your host, Ariel Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Sierra. The Pyramid Code is a documentary series of 5 episodes which explores the pyramid fields and ancient temples in Egypt, as well as ancient megalithic sites around the world, looking for clues to matriarchal consciousness, ancient knowledge, and sophisticated technology in a golden age. The series is based on the extensive research done in 25 trips to Egypt and 51 other countries around the world by our very distinguished guest, Dr. Carmen Bolger. She wrote, directed, and produced the series, which includes her extensive research in the archives of the Egyptian Museum, gaining official access to the Rare Books Library of the Faculty of Archaeology at Cairo University. She's also the author of Angels and Archetypes, an evolutionary map of feminine consciousness. Her latest achievement is InteractiveU.com, an online learning and social action network. Make sure to visit the website pyramidcode.com. Later, near the middle of the show, our guest from a few weeks ago, Renee Barnett, who's the producer of Bloodline the Movie, has organized a tour, according to requests from our Starseed audience, of Rennes Le Château in France. And her partner and co-producer, Gloria Amendola, will be joining us to give us an update on that October tour. Later in the second hour, we'll be hearing a report from two of our community, Maya and Rizine, of their otherworldly experiences in the Tetons while the Galactic Councils were meeting. We'd like to thank Purple Sage and Tammy for hosting the chat room and switchboard tonight. Purple Sage will be forwarding your questions to us from the chat room for those who can't call in. If you can call, our number is 917-889-8292. Then press 1 when prompted so we know you have something to say. You can also listen on your computer at blogtalkradio.com/starseed-radio-academy. And tonight, please make your questions as brief as possible. If you haven't yet, please click follow on our show page to help us increase our visibility. We're nearing the 50,000 listens mark, yet only 437 are official followers. So if you like the show, click follow and tell a friend. On our main site, which is starseedhotline.com, we have a lot of vital information for Starseed in our Vault of Knowledge. The entire site is coded for Starseed activation. We also have a support forum for Starseed at starseedhotline.ning.com. Plus, we're on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go. Lavendar and Dr. Bolger will be joining us in a few moments, but first I'd like to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. If you'd like our Stage 1 Starseed confirmation, you'll get your natal and progress charts plus an MP3 of your reading, pointing out and explaining your star markings if you have them. Our Stage 2 readings are a one-on-one phone consultation, which is available only after your confirmation if you want to go deeper. Make sure your birth info is exact to the minute and include your place of birth as well as your current place of residence. And if any of that is missing, it'll delay your reading until we can find out. And don't forget, if you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by requesting your solar return timing. Your manifestational ability is amplified 1,000-fold during those 10 hours, so make the most of it. And now I would like to introduce my co-hosts, Lavendar and Sierra. Good evening, ladies.
Lavendar here. We have a very exciting show, so I'm really
anxious to talk to Dr. Carmen.
Well, we are waiting for her to call in.
Okay.
We
don't have her up yet,
huh? We are waiting for her to call in. Not quite yet. If you would like to perhaps, we have Mercury retrograde right now. Oh, there she is. I was going to say, we do need to talk about that at some point tonight because this is a doozy of a Mercury retrograde this time. So without further ado, I would like to introduce, with great pleasure, Dr. Carmen Bolton. Bolter,
hello.
Excuse me. Hello, Dr. Bolter. How are you?
I'm fine. Yes, it is Mercury retrograde because I already spoke to the producer of the show, and then I guess I got put on hold, but I was here the whole time listening to you.
Oh, well, we just saw your number pop up, but, you know, after what's gone on this last week, I'm just not surprised if technology freaks out a little bit. So welcome. We are so excited to have you here.
Great. Me too. I'm excited to be here.
So,
okay, Lavendar here, Dr. Carmen. I was looking over your site, and I'm just so proud of the work that you've done. And I just, I don't really know where to start, except I think I'd like to hear a little bit about you as a person and how you became activated as a metaphysician and on this journey that you've been on. Can you tell us a little bit about your early background and waking up?
I started having past life memories as a little girl, and I could see things. I was already clairvoyant and clairaudient by the time I was about six, and I didn't understand what was going on, but I'm pretty sure I carried it in from other lifetimes.
Yeah, I think that most of us that do have those kind of memories, they just stream right through from lifetime to lifetime.
That's right.
Yeah. So,
Have I lived in Canada? I've lived in six different countries, and Canada is one of them.
Yeah, and okay, good. Well, you sent me a list of questions that are just very profound, so I want to get right to the questions. You posted some photos of strange apparitions during your sound and light show in Egypt last October, and it seems that there's a lot of curiosity about what they are. Any clues to what they might be?
Well, Wallace Thornhill and David Talbot, both of which I met in 1996 in Portland, have been talking about the electric universe and spinning plasma beings. William Henry has also been talking about that, and I'm going to be interviewed by him tomorrow on Revelations. When I was on with George Nuri last week on Coast to Coast AM, he said he thought that they were projections, like holograms that may have been coming from here. And then there was somebody sent me something about extraterrestrials who are also claiming that the Norway spiral and that sort of thing is like a projection from the other side coming into us. What I know is that I saw the blue one out of the corner of my eye before I started taking the pictures. And then I had an 18 megapixel digital SLR camera that was stationary as I was kneeling on the couch looking out the window at the sound and light show. And it's true that the apparitions they showed up a lot brighter in the camera than they did in my eye, and they were tested. These pictures were tested with angles for seeing if it could possibly be a lens flare. But I think you'll agree if you look at the photo series that's posted on my site, Pyramid Code, it's linked up to the front page, that it doesn't look like if the light is stationary and the sound and light show is making the pyramids a different color and the pyramids are stationary, it doesn't really look like it can be lens flare. So they're spinning, and William Henry said that ascended beings go to the galactic center and that they show themselves as light. So I guess there's been lots of talk of this over the ages, and lots of churches seem to have stained glass that would indicate these kinds of energies. But your guess is as good as mine. I wouldn't be, you know, so daring as to claim that I know what they are. But I also suspect that we're going to see more and more of this sort of thing.
Yeah, don't you think that each one of these things that happens, it becomes a piece of the tapestry of an entire story that's going to be presented to us, maybe a little at a time?
I agree. That's a lot of times that's how stories come to us, because we can't contain the entirety of a vision or of a past life memory at the same time. Now, I will say as well that this was at the end of my last Egypt trip when we were in the Great Pyramid on 10-10-10. And I had decided to do these groups before I realized the importance of the ascension portals that we were going to be going through. And it seemed to me that once the group had dissipated and I was staying for an extra couple of days and I had some time to just sit with myself, that it was to me, because the energy was all about the sacred feminine, to me, I called it the Holy Grail of the sacred feminine. And it seemed to me that that something was showing itself to me in the most obvious way, from the blue, because Hakim in the Pyramid Code talks about things coming from the blue. And to me, it made sense that it was a sacred feminine showing herself.
Well, that's great. This newly cleaned ceiling of the Temple of Deandra depicts some beings that are half animal and half human. What else does it reveal, and what is your interpretation of this?
Well, I've been going to Dendera for a long time, and it's the temple to Hathor, and the Hathors are described by Tom Kenyon, amongst others. And the ceiling is about 40 feet high, and it's been covered in this chocolatey color, and it's only in the last little while that they've managed to take the soot and the fungus that turned it, that chocolatey brown color, off to reveal these beings. And if anybody wants to look at these pictures, they're on the photos page on pyramidcode.com. And what you see is reptilian-headed beings, half animal and half human. And then there are goats that have four heads and wings that go in four directions. And to me, this is the processional cycle. And the whole thing is happening inside the body of Nui. And so her hands and feet are on the ground, and the Milky Way is the milk from her breasts. And then you see these solar boats that William Henry would call wormholes, and then this journey across the zodiac. So what we see is half animal, half human beings in solar boats going through wormholes across the entirety of the galactic pattern. And so you see the Pleiades are represented, Orion, and how he's manifested as Osiris. You see Isis, and she's apparently from Sirius. And it's like they're parading through the procession of the equinoxes as they manifest in four quarters of 6,500 years. So basically it's a you are here in the universal structure, in the galactic structure, and in the solar system. So it's absolutely astounding, A, that it was hidden, so we couldn't really interpret it. We could just see the outlines, and B, that the ancients knew about this. And the third part, C, is that it's very close to Nag Hammadi. So when you're driving to Dendera, you will see the sign. And Nag Hammadi is a place similar to where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, and the Nag Hammadi texts were found there. And what's curious about them, they've been newly interpreted as well, because the Christian zealots really couldn't understand how mystics thought. And John Lamb Lash and others are saying now that they are written in the voice of the divine feminine. So this is very, very important, because we are coming into a time where the feminine will, there will be a resurgence of the sacred feminine. And the entirety of the Mayan calendar has been patriarchal, including the dynastic periods of Egypt. And so the first dynasty of Egypt started at the same time as the beginning of the Mayan calendar. And it's my conviction that the patriarchy's agenda was to erase evidence of everything other than itself. So they changed this feminine goddess that had faith in us into a punitive god that we were supposed to have faith in, that was going to strike us down if we didn't obey him. And so I think that at the root of our problems right now is the fundamental switch out of the most important cultural myth. And I think we're about to get the right one back.
Oh, I think so too. I really do. You know, some time ago I had some information about Atlantis and how they did experiments with humans and animals and created creatures. And it was my understanding that some of that information that left Atlantis went to Egypt. Do you think that this bears true in some of the depictions of the things that you've seen there?
Absolutely, and Dendera is not the only place that you see Therianthropes, as Graham Hancock would call them, but he also talks about them being as fourth-dimensional beings, and that makes a lot of sense as well. And so in his experiences with ayahuasca, the hallucinogenic drug in South America, he's seen many half-animal, half-humans. Now, I think that the Atlanteans probably took it further and turned it into something actually a genetic combination. And then we're doing that, too, with the sheep and all of that. So, yes, I think that the Egyptians were depicting something that was from a long-lost past and something that would give us cues when we woke up in this period of time right now.
Right. So there was probably a long line of patriarchs that decided that they wanted to erase women. So is that one of the reasons that you feel like that the statues of women in Egypt have been destroyed?
Absolutely. And recently they found one of the biggest statues ever found in Egypt, and it was of a feminine deity. And somebody was digging for a well, as you typically find things in Egypt that are under villages. And it's this enormous, enormous statue of a feminine deity, and you don't see it showing up at the museum. In fact, the museum has fewer and fewer items in it than it used to for various reasons. But, yeah, this thing has been found, and it's not on display. So the tail end of the patriarchy and the patriarchs that ran it are still trying to keep that away from the common knowledge.
Yeah, okay. I understand that you've been continuing your work on the sky-ground correlations with the pyramids north and south of the Giza Plateau and constellations of stars. Is there anything new that you've discovered that you can tell us about?
Well, yes. I started working in Starry Night Pro, which is the program that shows the entirety of the sky, and it dates back all the way. Like, you can make the program go all the way back to 99,999 BC and forward to that much AD. And I was trying to figure out, like, if Robert Bovall is correct, and I assume he is, with the belt of Orion being represented by the three pyramids on the Giza Plateau, the band of peace is six distinct sites, north and south, and there's other star systems that would be part of that. And so I was trying to figure out, well, what is this, and why is it important, and what are we actually looking at? And so working with Abu Roush, which you can't go to, it's in the pyramid code, it's the pyramid that's up a mountain, it would stand to reason that it was Sirius, so I plotted that in, and I plotted in Orion, and on the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera, you will see Isis is behind Osiris, and she's got her hand around his waist. And if you look at just those two star systems in the configuration, you'll see that they always hang together, no matter, they never split apart and go into different orbits, if you will. And so then I added the Pleiades, which corresponds to the next site down, Abu Sir. And then I was trying to figure out, well, where is all this headed? And then the Egyptians speak a lot about Cygnus, and so I plotted it to be where Dashur is. And then I started to run this pattern. I'm still not sure what Saqqara is. The jury's not out on that yet. But when I ran this configuration, it never comes apart. But if you keep going along the extragalactic meridian, which is a line that goes straight through all of these configurations that I just said, corresponding to the pyramids on the ground, where do you think you go? If you follow the beak of Cygnus, which is like a swan, and the spinal cord of this bird is where the galactic meridian goes straight through, you arrive at the center of the galaxy.
Is that 26 Sagittarius? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes,
okay.
I am saying that. And then if you go all the way back to 50,000 BC or forward, this configuration stays together. Now, it is just absolutely unbelievable, because with our sophisticated technology now, we're still having a problem figuring it all out. And it was plain as day to the Egyptians, and they went to the trouble of putting these huge pyramidal structures, and there's 22 pyramids in the entire configuration on the Band of Peace on six sites. And it's basically saying the anchor point is Sirius, and the whole thing leads us into the galactic center. And it also shows that Walter Crittenden's work, looking at us in a binary star system with our sun, is that when you plot the extragalactic, and anybody can do this if you have the program Starry Night Pro. So if you plot the extragalactic grid, and the meridian, everything rotates all the way around Sirius. And so it stands to reason that we're very connected to these systems, and it fits with the whole idea of star seeds and Nefertiti and Akhenaten likely being from Sirius. And so all these bits and pieces are coming together, and of course traditional archaeology has a terrible time with Nefertiti and Akhenaten. They think they were, you know, deranged and crazy and deformed and everything else, and I think the easiest way to explain who they were is that they were starseed. So all that's pretty interesting.
Well, they had the distended skulls, right? Every picture I've ever seen of them, their heads were really different.
That's right. And they also had some kind of an Asian-looking eye, and then distended bellies as well. And so basically what the traditional Egyptologists say is that the distended skulls were stylized. But now the work of Brian Forstner and David Hatchett-Childress, you know, they're finding these skulls all over the world. But there's a real distinction between ones that were natural and ones that were copied or deformed to do that. And you can always see there's marks on the skull. If the skull was squished and bound, you can see the difference between those and the natural ones. And apparently the shape of the skull allowed the pineal gland, which is what gives us our consciousness and our higher levels of psychicness, it gave more room within the skull, within the cavity, for the pineal gland to expand. And it seems that people who did not have that naturally understood how it was important, and then they were the ones that were doing the unnatural distended skulls in order, hopefully, ostensibly, to increase their consciousness.
So you're writing, your new book is about the 18th dynasty of Egypt, is that right?
Yes, yes, I'm co-writing that book. And we're going to be taking some pretty strong steps here into the idea of starseed and looking at the distended skulls and what it means, but also re-examining the time frame, because it seems to me that Nefertiti and Akhenaten would have had more than one incarnation. They may have come back during the Amarna period, but everything was getting pretty dark with the Amun priesthood during that time, and yet they were remembering things that were percolating up from a time where we would have been in more of a golden age, where consciousness and 12-strand DNA would have been normal. And so there's a real mystery lurking inside that. And what's true in traditional Egyptology is only one person was ever allowed to lead teams to do any kind of excavation at Amarna, and that was Barry Kemp. There was another Egyptologist that was allowed to do the tombs up on the cliffs, but in terms of the ground plan of the new city that Nefertiti and Akhenaten started, only one archaeologist was ever allowed to do any work there, which really narrows down the interpretations. And so what we see is the wrong story is getting passed down and repeated and repeated. But there's definitely some very, very strong secrets and mysteries that are hiding in there.
You know, I do a lot of work with star seeds that are walk-ins, and part of my training for 30 years has been about the walk-ins that have come to this planet. I'm just curious, did you find any evidence in any of your trips that maybe walk-ins would come and participate with the royal family?
I can only say yes to that. It's impossible to prove, and this is the journey that we're on to try to find a way to explain this in the physical reality. But you often will see on the temple walls how they were participating with, and they have stars around their heads, and they're somehow communicating with a higher force. And so it stands to reason that walk-ins would have come and gone. It makes sense to me.
Yeah, me too. Well, are there any other places that evidence of beings that had these distended skulls that have been found? What do you think their origins were? And how many different ET experiments do you think were involved in this? Have you had any evidence of that?
Well, those are two big questions. So the first one is literally all over the world there have been distended skulls found. And I personally saw one at the Ica Museum, where the Ica stones were found, where you see man riding dinosaurs and brain transplants happening with transfusions from a pregnant female, and all kinds of things of Gondwana land, where, you know, before the land masses split up for the earth to look the way it does now, and connections to the Pleiades. And all of this is recorded in these stones, and found nearby was a natural distended skull. Okay, now it's slightly different shape. It's not as bulbous on the back of it as they were in Amarna, because you see many, many statues and frescoes depicting those. So I think there's variations on that theme. But literally, and then the other thing too is that if these things were found, they were hidden again, which, you know, ties into the work of Michael Cremo and forbidden archaeology, because if it doesn't fit with the, you know, the paradigm of what, you know, we're describing things as, archaeologists are very, very quick to get rid of stuff, as you know, right?
When you were there, did you happen to see any ET ships in the area and lights, and did they make themselves known on your trips?
Oh, yeah, I've seen a lot of that sort of thing, and I've also been able to photograph a lot of it. And there's a phenomenon known as orbs, and what I found over the years is the orbs have become more and more complex, and because we've got stronger cameras with higher levels of megapixels, you can blow up these orbs and see the cellular matrix. And so I think that it's beings. They like to be around the energy of the sacred sites. They like to be around you know, laughter and singing and dancing and cosmic kinds of things. And so when we go on the horse and camel rides at sunset and have a dancing horse party, we see it's like a blizzard looking at pictures. And so one time when we were taking pictures, it was almost like if you were to shine a light with soda water effervescing, and you see little, and the light was recording off the flashing off the little bubbles that were coming up. And then the orbs were showing up in the pictures. So I have a whole series of pictures over the years of lots and lots and lots of light beings. And now we're seeing, you know, sheets of light and bands of light in photographs. And so it seems that as our energy becomes more refined, then the spiritual energy can densify a little bit and we can bridge in the middle. And now our cameras are able to show that. But having said that, in 1977, with a plain film camera, the first time I was alone inside the Great Pyramid, I took pictures, and these pictures were full of pink and green apparitions that almost looked like smoke, if nothing else, but like kind of faded at the top and bottom, but had a little bit more substance in the middle. And I was just, you know, 22 years old at the time. And so I marched myself down to a camera store and asked what was wrong with my camera, and the guy took the whole thing apart and looked at it and said, nothing. Nothing's wrong with your camera. And so I had never even heard of such a thing, or, you know, the interaction of that sort of thing that we could actually take pictures of. And so there's more and more of that, and I also have a series that I call the Metatron series, because there's these huge, powerful bands of red that are along the Grand Causeway on the Giza Plateau, wrapping around the Sphinx's head. Now that I'm mentioning these, I think I'll have to post them on the photos page after the interview here, so people can go and see what I'm talking about.
Right. I was in Egypt in 81 and again in 83. And the trip in 83, on our website, there's a picture of me with my arms up, and there's some hieroglyphic writing behind me. But what I'm finding in my pictures is that each year there's another hieroglyph that appears on the picture. It's like it's unfolding itself, you know, year after year. More writings are happening, and they weren't there at the beginning.
On the existing picture?
On the existing picture.
Wow, that's a good one.
I know.
Yeah, it's actually pretty amazing. This is Sierra, and I actually saw that picture, and as depending on who was holding that picture, different hieroglyphics would actually start to appear in the background.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
been
a mystery to me.
You know, and on the same note, but something a little different, like I was really fascinated with those pictures when the camera guy told me that my camera wasn't broken. And I have every single picture from that trip except those. And somehow they disappeared. And I was really careful with them. And so, you know, there's some, you know, mysterious things that happen with mysterious objects and ideas.
There's another picture on our website of the pyramid, and it shows an entrance, a hole. But in actuality, that's not really there. So that was another trick picture that we came home with.
Oh. Well, very interesting. Go ahead.
It's really there, but it's just not visible to the naked eye, but it came out on the film.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
And that's the thing. We can train ourselves. You know how those stereograms work, where you look at them and they just look like a bunch of jumbled images, but then when you kind of put yourself in a neutral spot and stop looking at things, then it becomes 3D and you can look through. But if you try too hard, you can't do it. And just because you did it once doesn't mean you can do it again. And so that, to me, speaks to the idea that we need to have a certain disposition and be in a certain, you know, consciousness in order to be able to even perceive these things. And it seems that the new digital cameras are able to pick up these energies and magnify them a little bit, very much like infrared cameras can see spirit beings on film. Have you seen
another
any of those?
Another picture, I don't have it any longer, I lost it, but Gail Flanagan was laying in the sarcophagus. And as these pictures started to develop later, I saw little fairy beings that were in her hands inside the crystals she was holding.
Aw.
And, of course, she's left the planet now, and we all miss her. But I was also curious to know, there were two beings in Egypt that helped me get inside the pyramid. One, in 81, was a guy named Champion, and another guy that helped me was Mahmoud in 83. Did you happen to meet either one of those?
Well, I've got a big file about Champion, for sure, because he was the one that had the keys to the pyramids before Zahi Hawass had them, and I'm a friend of their family. And so I met the Champion in 1994, I believe, and he's also departed now. But yes, and I know the family very well.
How about Mahmoud?
No, that Dodi Fayed, his name was Hefnawi Fayed, and he would have been Princess Di's Dodi's first cousin.
Oh, goodness.
And at the end of the British occupancy.
Crossed over. He was about 65 then, so I'm sure he's gone.
Uh-huh. All the land around, well, many, many people's name is Mahmoud, so I wonder which one you meant. But, all the land around the Giza Plateau at the end of the British occupancy was given to their grandfather, and Dodi and his family moved to Alexandria and then on to London, and Champion's family stayed right there, right beside the Sphinx at the foot of the Great Pyramid, and they still have their homes there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you and I can probably talk later about Champion. He was quite a character.
Oh, yeah, he sure was.
Yeah. Okay.
And in some indirect
in episode
way,
4 of the Pyramid Code, it's called The Empowered Human. Are you suggesting that ancient Egyptians were more empowered than we are today? And in what ways would you say that we are disempowered?
Well, I think in pretty much every way there is, because now we're at the bottom of the Iron Age, in the lowest and densest part of the Yuga cycles. And I think that empowered humans were at the highest end of the Golden Age. And so things get denser and denser and denser. But another way that you can look at it, and I learned this also in Starry Night Pro, is that when we are in elliptical orbits, when we are the closest to Sirius, when the sun is the closest to Sirius, is when the Golden Age is. And it takes 13,000 years to get the farthest away, and that's where we are right now. And so now things are disconnected, and patriarchy is all about, you know, divide and conquer, and about power over instead of personal empowerment. And so we're also operating on 2-strand DNA instead of 12-strand DNA. And so I think that the ancients who lived in the Golden Age were actually trying to keep that energy around, knowing we were going to plunge into a bloodbath. The other thing about the Golden Age, it would have been respecting blood from life, as in that menstrual blood was the highest form of DNA. And then when the patriarchs started to take over, they were still having the virgin mother and crone colors, red, white, and black. They were wearing the dress of the goddess, the hat of the pharaohs, and then they started making blood sacrifices. And blood from death is not the same thing as blood from life. I don't have to tell you that. And so now we're, you know, we're in a bloodbath, and you know, the business of America is war, and people are frustrated, disempowered, and unplugged as a consequence. However, we're right at the time where we're turning the corner, and we're going to have energetic opportunities to open up and work our way back into empowerment as a species, as a humanity, and as individuals.
You know, I've been tracking something from the August Harmonic Convergence of 87, and I'm finding that a lot of people are showing up and acknowledging that that was kind of a turning point for them in their lives to be activated into their starseed codes or to their awakening. Are you finding that in 1987 that you're seeing this too?
Well, absolutely. I had a remarkable experience that weekend of August 17th and 18th. I had been working with people who were learning to channel, and I think it was William David was teaching that way back in those years, and he had a program that took 5 years for people to channel. So the day before Harmonic Convergence, my girlfriend called me up and said, I'm going to a channeling workshop, you need to be there. I went, oh, okay, and she said, we're going to learn to channel in the weekend. I'm like, oh, come on, how's that going to happen? And sure enough, we were in the energy, and we learned it, and I became a conscious channel that weekend, and it was as real could be. And I'll never forget something that happened. It was Janet Birch that taught us, Janet Birch. And after we had the first experience, somebody in the class said, well, how do I know I'm not making it up? And she said dryly, you're not smart enough to make it up. So ever since then, but that was a big gift to me, because you just let go and say, okay, I'm letting go of my lower self and surrendering to my higher self, and I'm accepting what I hear, and no, I wouldn't make it up. So that was a real release, and I think that those kinds of instructions, coupled with the energy, coupled with the modeling of the people who had been doing it for years and learned it the hard way, really gave us a leg up. But the whole thing really had everything to do with Harmonic Convergence.
Right. Have you been to the Yucatan? Have you seen the pyramids in Mexico?
You know what? I haven't. I've been to Mexico, and I have not been to the sacred sites down there. And I guess I thought, well, they're nice and close, so in my youth I'll look everywhere farther away, and when I'm older I'll go down there. But it's interesting that, you know, for having been to 52 countries, that's not somewhere I've explored.
Well, they're probably saving the best for last, because I know there's a lot of feminine energy that was placed, especially at Tulum, you know.
Okay.
So that'd be a really interesting place for you to research, because it was the place of the goddess. And they did a lot of baby experiments from Tulum. So just might make note
of
that.
Well, and then it turned sour, and then there was all the blood sacrifice and cutting out people's hearts and stuff. And I think that really turned me off, because I know that there was something really sacred and nonviolent prior to all of that, what I call nonsense.
Yeah, right. Okay. The ancient Egyptians have many depictions of gods and goddesses with stars above their heads. And how do you interpret these?
Well, exactly. It's like, you know, it's almost like they come from the stars. One of them, Sechet, which is the name for the people, has got a line coming straight out her crown chakra, and then a star right out the top of her head. So you've got to wonder if that doesn't spell starseed. Now, we don't really have that in our vocabulary, but there are stories of Hatshepsut, for example, who was also in the 18th dynasty earlier in the lineage, and she speaks of her father being taken over by an ascended being and impregnating her mother. And so when she was born, that made her half starseed. And she lived by that idea, and she was one of the first that was bringing back the idea of true spirituality as opposed to religion and paying for your salvation, as the Amun priesthood in the darker ages was dragging things into, you know, a denser field. And so the fact that that they keep showing these stars near their heads and star maps like the Pleiades, I think is completely about us finding a way to understand what that could mean. And whether it's walk-ins or visitations or them walking along beside, or we're them and we came from other systems and now we're in human form, or all of the above, I think it's incumbent upon us to figure it out and talk to one another about it. And there's very little, in my world, very little opportunity to talk about starseeds, I'll tell you that. So I was quite amused when I saw your invitation to be on your show.
Well, that's all we talk about. we're full-fledged starseed agenda. I mean, that's our main focus, and people that call in and talk to us on the radio show, people that come to have sessions with us, people are wanting to know more and more about their heritage and their starseed markings in their charts. And thank you for sending me your information, and I'm going to call you later, and I will talk to you about your star markings in your chart, and you have many, of course. That's not surprising. I find that people that do this work really have, it's like before you came, you said, before I come down there, this is what I want. And I don't want it to be, you know, mistaken for anything else, because when I get ready to stand up and speak about it or stand in my power, you know, it's like you have all the things. It's like your car. Your car's got to have satellite radio now and push-button windows and automatic seat. Well, that's kind of how we designed ourselves when we came down here. That's what I'm finding to be true.
Well, I certainly had a lot of visions as a little girl, and I knew, like when I had that first major one with the Egyptian priestess, immediately a voice came in my head that said, don't tell anyone. And I was like 6 years old, like, you know how, you know, tall a six-year-old is. And I remember looking around kind of thinking, I'm not sure who's talking, but you know what? I think that's a really good idea, because I, you know, would only have to spend a nanosecond thinking about telling my mother about that. And I knew that wasn't going to work.
Right. Okay. You're developing an online learning and social action network called interactive.u.com. And what is it? How does it work? And how will it serve the changing needs of our learners? Will there be courses relevant to these esoteric studies? Just tell us about it.
Sure. Well, it's interactive-u.com. And it came to me just over the years of teaching online and seeing what the education system has been doing to people, because I've been an educator for a long time. And this business of student loans, and then people, you know, end up with degrees in worthlessness, and then they're enslaved to the debt of it. And at the end, they don't know how to market themselves or build a website or, you know, what's relevant to publishing a book or how to even make a YouTube video and upload it. They just don't know anything. And so I think most of us need to be self-employed and to be connected to our life's mission. And school kind of tries to make us all the same instead of making us different. The other thing is many things are age-restricted, and in this for sure, a 10-year-old or a 90-year-old can take the courses, but also to weave between different disciplines and come together with something that's like a project that then, you know, has some relevance to how we can help with it. So the motto that Sir Francis Bacon made a statement way back when, and he said, the greatest end of life is not knowledge, but action. And so, you know, how can we post what we've, you know, learned and make news stories and that sort of thing. And so there's 12 faculties. I'm just basically coming out with this now. It's not even fully together yet in terms of the website's being built in terms. It's iTunes meets Facebook meets YouTube, but all in an educational context and specific to Interactive U. So the courses will be inexpensive. So now I'm working on the back office where, you know, it's encrypted so that people can, you know, get into the portals and see various equipment. And, sorry, I just got a phone call and it distracted me. See the various publications that will come on the electronic portfolios. And so everybody's a teacher, everybody's a learner. And so I want to learn animation, so I'll take the animation course. And everything's based on interactivity. And I think this is very relevant, because with the sage on the stage instead of the guide at the side, the way teacher-centered teaching, as opposed to learner-centered learning, basically says, I'm at the front, so I know. You're in the seats, so you don't. And I think that model of education doesn't work at all. It's also deconstructive, so we deconstruct Shakespeare and we critique something, as opposed to being constructive, where we make something, build something, make, you know, something tangible that's creative. And so all of this will be online, and we'll see, like, the instructor will be a host, and they will interview other teachers that are in the field, and then I think that that's very interesting for people to listen to. Well, I do it this way, and I use this program. Well, what do you? Well, I, you know, my experience taught me this, and listening to, you know, people discuss, so you learn that there's more than one way to do something, and people have, you know, they're connected in various ways. And so then there'll be breakaway groups where there'll be teaching assistants, and then there'll be enabling tasks, and then people will come back to the main group. And then certain people will move on and do projects, but there'll be things like I've got a team right now in Bolivia, and they're doing interviews because there's just been a new piece of legislation passed that says that Mother Earth has as many rights as anybody else. And so my team is looking into, you know, who started that, you know, what's it going to do to their society to have included that. And, again, that's a relevant step to going back to the goddess and, honoring the earth and all of that instead of everything's me and mine and we can destroy the planet. So everything that we're doing within Interactive U is about the new way. If it has anything to do with the old way, I'm not interested. And so I'd like to, you know, students will end up with electronic portfolios, and so when they go to get a job or go to, you know, apply to other schools, if they want to do that after, their employer can ask for their electronic portfolio, and we can certify that they've actually built this stuff. And so I would rather, as an employer, instead of seeing somebody's piece of paper that says they went to a website building program, to see a website they built. You understand what I'm saying? So I would like to see that employers say, have you got any Interactive U credits? Because they become like on the ground, hands-on, creative, useful, and socially relevant and helpful to humanity. So some people say when they're not familiar with online learning, well, what are you going to do, sit at the computer all day? But actually quite the contrary. You may be doing a project on whales and their environment, film the whole thing. You're in the field with colleagues the whole day and the whales, and then you come home and upload the video. So you're not sitting at the computer, but you're digitizing the results to then be able to share it. So one of the first people who heard about Interactive U said he thought it was the democratization of accomplishment, which I thought was a very nice way of putting it.
Oh, I love this. Is very exciting. You know, we have a friend over at Sparrowhawk Village in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, Carol Parrish, and she has a metaphysical school where you can go get your PhD in metaphysics. I would love for her to add your program to their agenda. That would just complete everything for them over there. I think this is very exciting. You're really a pioneer, aren't you?
Yeah, apparently. That's why I had to have the electric windows coming in.
You had to have the satellite radio, too. Yeah.
And all that. Yeah, I did come in with a lot of gifts. My first mentor said to me, to whom much is given, much is expected.
That's true.
So, yes, but we do have a faculty of esoteric studies. And we'll be teaching astrology, and there's a man who's been doing the landscape zodiac, and that's really a whole new concept, but I'm sure the Egyptians were onto it about that sort of thing, about how the grid of the earth can actually contain the archetypes as well. And that fits with my book, which is Angels and Archetypes, An Evolutionary Map of Feminine Consciousness. And so basically we're, you know, going back and picking up all the pearls that fell off our necklaces and stringing them back together and approaching what the ancients knew and also getting cues from what they left us. And
right.
So I think that this will accumulate into a body of work where we'll be able to understand ourselves a lot better and be able to share it as well. So, yes, I feel very strongly about this idea, and the gentleman who's doing the encryption, because everybody will have their own Interactive U page, which, and they'll exchange, so it'll be like $1.99 to read a paper or watch a video or that sort of thing. So it's, you know, before they said that we were pirates and that we weren't willing to pay for music and we were stealing it, but there was no way to get it. And now that, you know, we can spend 99 cents on a song, we're doing it because there's a way to do it. And so it's not charging a lot for anything, but if something is recognized and a million people want to go click, then you have the opportunity to make $1 million from it. And so students will also be able to publish if their stuff is up to speed. And then that material will be used in other courses as well. So, and then everybody will have their own interactive U page, which will show courses they've taken, courses they're in, courses they want to take, different materials that they downloaded and their opinion about it. They can friend somebody and say, well, I want to go do a research project down in, you know, Guatemala. And somebody says, okay, I'll come, or, you know, like organizing around that. And then we'll be posting videos. And so that's where iTunes meets Facebook meets YouTube.
Oh, and then after disclosure will be happening about this time, I hope. And we'll have lots of pictures of ships everywhere.
Well, right. Well, even if it's just, you know, a forum where we can post these things and look at them, I mean, there's only so much denial that can go on and political agendas that keep everything hidden. So
yeah.
It's time for all these pieces to come together, and I think something like Blood Talk Radio gives people the space if they want to do their own radio show. So Internet has really helped us, and, you know, I don't know if it's going to stick around forever or not, but as long as we've got it, I think there's a certain sense of urgency, particularly during these times, as we're marching our way very quickly toward December 21st, 2012, where the exact galactic alignment happens.
That's true. That's true. Well, I have enjoyed talking to you so much. I'm going to turn you over now to Ariel and to Sierra to finish talking with you. And they're hooked up to the chat room and also the switchboard. So I'll talk to you later, Doc.
Okay, thanks, Lavender.
Well, this is Ariel. And Dr. Carmen, I just want to say how much I admire you and what you have accomplished. And you have effectively bridged the gap between science, academia, and metaphysics, spirituality, and just found some cohesiveness within all of that. And I know it's not easy to do as an academician to incorporate, like you say, there's some things that you would never talk about, blending science and spirituality, but they're really... That's really where we're going, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of weeks ago, we had a guest named Robert Morningstar, and he wrote a paper that was finding correlation between formations on Mars and the Great Pyramid. Are you aware of his work?
I'm aware of his work. I met him way back when at the Star Visions Conference in Santa Fe. And absolutely, there's a lot of parallels up there in the area of the region of Cydonia up on Mars. And again, you know, best-kept secrets that leak out. But it makes sense that there would be representations of similar things on the planet, on other planets in the solar system. To me, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Like remnants. And what we have here is a replication of what has been done elsewhere. I mean, he even has like high-resolution photographs where you can see ancient, like Egyptian-looking things carved into the surface. It was just fascinating.
There's even a head of Nefertiti up there with that famous funny-shaped hat covers funny-shaped head, I always say. So we've got the descended skull crown.
Right. There is so much to the big picture, and I think you've really got a good handle on it. I'm sure the places that you've gone. Have you been to Greece and done the whole, Greek temples and Parthenon?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been to Greece 7 times. And seven of the goddesses that just happens in my book are Greek goddesses. And so that was a later time period, but it was also following the archetypal energy from before. And so absolutely. And I also was leading sacred site journeys to the temples of the goddess in the whole Mediterranean basin. I don't have one scheduled now, but I suspect I'll get back to that. And that may be another topic for a documentary series as well.
Oh, I'm sure it is. Sierra? Hello, Sierra.
Yes. Hello. Hello.
I'm going to be checking in with the chat room here in a few minutes. So heads up to Purple Sage to check in with the chat room with some questions, but if you have anything that you would like to ask Dr. Carmen, please go
I
ahead.
I sure do. Absolutely. Well, first of all, I second everything that you said, that Ariel said about Dr. Carmen. So I just really, really appreciate the work that you've done. And I have a very touchy question to ask you. And I want to be very poignant about what I'm asking is, it's about the divine feminine and the patriarchal design to take the divine feminine out of history. What do you think? Why? And when I say why, what would be the agenda of doing something like that? What is it about the divine feminine that so challenges the patriarchal rule? And why so many years ago would they have a choice to launch this campaign to degrade the divine feminine?
You're right. It's a touchy question. My first answer, I think, is a psychological reason, and I think it's plain and simple, procreation envy. In the times when famine was ever imminent and we were hunter-gatherers, women would procreate every 5 years, and then some of them thought, hey, we can take these plants and bring them close to the mouth of the cave, and they had horticulture, and then they started to plant them in rows, and then they had agriculture, and then there was enough grain left over, and then the women had more meat on them, and so they were able to procreate every year. And then all of a sudden men went, hey, we have something to do with this. But prior to that, you know, babies were magic, and they just came out of nowhere, and men were just completely in awe and honoring of the feminine. So when Freud came along and said that women had penis envy, and as I say, I've never met a woman who would prefer to have outdoor plumbing. So, I mean, I think that was just all, that's just all fabricated. That's on one level. On another level, I've written a screenplay which is based on, you know, past life memories of this long journey in Egypt that had more than one incarnation. And one of them went back before the pyramids were built, probably 50,000 BC, something like that. But, you know, the timing was all... our sense of the space-time continuum has changed, let's put it that way. And my understanding is that there was a war of gods and men, and there were some beings that, and I see them as reptilian, rubbery all the way through with their slimy tails, and they said, we want the Earth, and if you don't give it to us, we're going to blow it up. And the Galactic Federation of Planets came in and said, I don't think so. And they said, okay, well, we're blowing it up then, so what are you going to do? And they went, well, it's not allowed in this free will space in the universe, right? And they said, well, we want it, so do something. So the decision was that they would get it for one cycle of the Mayan calendar, and that ended up being the Mayan cycle. So they launched in 3113 BC, started the dynasties, started the patriarchal stuff, started erasing all the feminine, and over time they got rid of it altogether, and now we're in the end of this where everything's disconnected. Mother Earth is bleeding and shaking, and everything's falling apart, and it's over. But their agenda to erase everything other than itself was so that at the end, when we said, okay, give us back the keys, it's our turn now, get out of here. Right? We're doing it our way now, different way. Not women with power over men, but empowerment for everybody and enough of this destruction stuff. We would be so dumbed down where aspartame meets fluoride, meets chemtrails, meets everything else, right? That we would say, what keys? What feminine? And there's a good number of people who are steeped in patriarchal religions, which is separate and distinct from spirituality, that are completely lost and don't think that there's something on the other side. Because the patriarchy's thing is, if you can't see it, it's not there. Well, whose eyes are looking? Right? Two-strand DNA eyes, or, you know, DNA eyes from another space and time where we had more sanity and more abilities. So I think that's what happened.
Well, that is an excellent, excellent answer, and I really do appreciate that. And so that's just so amazing that you actually brought in, you know, when they came in. That's just, in my eyes, absolutely accurate. I am a Pleiadian walk-in, and it's so refreshing to know that people like yourselves are down here spreading that word around. So thank you for your work. Thank you for answering that question. It was an important one to answer. And thank you for your time.
Well, and you know what? I feel really excited to be talking to you. And I think that I've just finished my contract at the University of Calgary on June 30th, and I'm completely freelance. And I've been out there saying what I have to say and working with the esoteric material and, you know, keeping things in separate compartments. But, you know, I'm about done with hanging out with people who don't get it, to tell you the truth.
So absolutely. Well, I would love to have a conversation with you as a sidebar sometime. And if that would be okay with you, I'll get your information from Lavendar. But, again, thank you for the work that you're doing and for what you're saying, because it's very important.
Well, I'm delighted to be speaking to you.
Well, we are going to be speaking to the chat room. Sierra, thank you so much. And I hope, apparently, Purple Sage is having a little Mercury retrograde issue with their headset, but let's see if I can get it turned on here. Purple Sage,
are you
there?
Does anybody want to try to explain that, why Mercury retrograde is so incredibly invasive into our space? I mean, we watch it coming, and we're almost get all that stuff done before it happens. It's incredible
right, well,
what it can do to a day, isn't it?
It sure is. I mean, it scrambles your brain a little bit, and it certainly wreaks havoc with anything electrical, technological, and you know, you just have to roll with it and be glad it only lasts for. We got two more weeks to go. So, Purple Sage, are you with us? Oh, I could just barely hear you.
Okay, I'm on the phone.
Did you pick up on my cell phone? Oh. Yeah, well, Purple Sage, we just can't. I cannot hardly hear at anything you're saying. So, no, we still can't hear it.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, that's because I took the headset off and was talking on my phone.
When you put the headset on, it works, but it doesn't work without it?
Well, the one that I usually use just totally copped out on me during the show. And so I'm using this old set, and I didn't know if it would work. So I called in thinking that you would pick up on the phone. But that's okay. This works, so that's cool.
Okay, what's happening in the chat room tonight?
Everybody is so excited about tonight's show, and the conversation is just totally buzzing about the conversation on the show, which doesn't always happen. I do have a comment from somebody in the chat room regarding the elongated skulls. And she said in some tribes throughout the world, actually, they wrap their babies' skulls in tight wraps, which causes the skull to become elongated. And there was a conversation that, you know, possibly that was a way for remembering. Possibly it is a way of, you know, copying the gods, whatever. But that was a conversation that was going on.
Yeah, I agree. And I said some of that it would make enough room within the skull for the pineal gland to be enlarged. The
mm-hmm.
pineal gland looks like an acorn. And if you go to the Vatican, you'll see that the largest piece in the Vatican gallery or at the outdoor place is a huge pine cone, and you often see the goddess with a pine cone in her hand, and it's almost like the extension of our clairvoyance and clairaudience, like the inside of the head that's like its own eye. And so I think that the thinking was, if the ancients who had the abilities of manifestation, teleportation, bilocation, alchemy, all of that, that if they were able to make more room in the cranium, that the children may have more psychic abilities. That's one interpretation of it.
Uh-huh.
But you can, when they're wrapped, sometimes they were wrapped with a board inside, you can actually see the flat parts of where the board was, and you can see when it was done to them instead of them being born with that.
Do you have any thoughts on somebody like a Down syndrome person having, they have the larger heads. They also have the ability to communicate.
They absolutely have the most unbelievable pure heart.
Yes.
And a dissociation with our social rules. So they often seem a little inappropriate in our sit down, be quiet, don't say that kind of thing that we teach kids, and they can't grasp that. So in some ways they come with an asocial, like outside of our sociocultural context, huge heart, and certain intuition, definitely certain intuition. And so I think they're absolutely fascinating. And the Egyptians, particularly in the 18th dynasty, when they started doing the mummification, were pulling the brains out the nose and throwing them away because they thought that the seat of intelligence and wisdom was the heart. And so if that's what Down syndromes have got, you know, they can be tremendously successful if we allow them to function and don't impose our social rules on them, right?
Yep, absolutely. Thank you. Another question is, Hakim passing his secret or his sacred knowledge down, or how can it be preserved? Another part of this question is, are the hieroglyphs and the ancient knowledge that Hakim has being recorded for the information before someone graffitis over the cave walls, or before it just kind of blows away to dust?
Okay, well, the first part of the question is that the motivation for the pyramid code, I mean, it came from several places. And well, one of them, I was already making video tutorials, and so I understood how to make film, but in a very, you know, beginning kind of way. But it was obvious that Hakim wasn't going to last forever, and he had been my mentor for 10 years. And I met these director and a producer from Hollywood who basically said, we've got to record this man. We've got to, you know, preserve his knowledge. But the thing is that when there were no ears to hear what he had to say, he sounds ridiculous. I've got 48 pages of single-spaced transcripts from his interviews. We had 9 hours of interviews. And, you know, the director was kind of like, I didn't keep him around because he didn't really understand. But, you know, he'd be like, I don't understand. I don't get it. I said, okay, you got to let him talk. Let him talk to me. You be a fly on the wall. And then I'm going to pair it with scientists that corroborate what he's saying and bridge it with narration and animations, okay? Then you'll understand what he's saying, right? And maybe not everything he's saying. So I noticed after the pyramid code was finished and locked that I went to a few conferences where there were other scientists who were saying things that he had said that I didn't use because no one was talking about that. So Hakim has come from an indigenous, he's an indigenous wisdom keeper who was born at the foot of the pyramids at Abu Sir, which is just like 5-6 miles down the road from Giza, where he lives now, lived, and his family's still there. So, and I studied with him, well, I considered him to be my mentor for 10 years. But honestly, if I just asked him a question about something, he'd say, nothing. But if I came back and said, is it this, this, and this, and Nefertiti and Akhenaten and the spirituality in the 18th dynasty, well, then he would talk to me, after I already knew. So that was the kind of tough taskmaster that he was, because he would not give anything up unless I already knew it. But boy, would he get excited when I figured it out myself, and we would sit there for days and hours, just talk, 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 talk. So what I've noticed with him is that his knowledge was a bit hidden when he was alive, if you know what I mean, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I've only been back to the family home on one trip, but I went there several times since he passed away. And it's 3 years ago this week, actually, that he passed away. And I was absolutely, he's got 11 children. He married and divorced the same woman 3 times and kept having more kids. And it seemed to me that they kind of left him alone and, you know, respected him as an elder, but didn't really get involved in his work. Now, perhaps on the sidelines they did. And, you know, the kids lived everywhere. And at 9-1-1, they all came back to live basically in Egypt and some of them in the family home. But this time when I was back, all of a sudden it was like they realized who he was in retrospect, and it seemed like his presence was fuller in the home after he went. And I was still shaking my head about it. And now, you know, on my website under the video tab, there's his son talking about the revolution, and they're standing on the second floor balcony, and you see the Sphinx right beside him and the pyramid out the other shoulder. And his son, Yosef, and daughter, Zahira, is her nickname, are continuing the work and doing rituals and taking people into the pyramid and, you know, guiding tours sometimes and that sort of thing. And so that's it. That's all we've got. Now, Barbara Hanclau did the 9 initiations along the Nile. Stephen Mailer's done some work with him and written some books about it. And then we have the linguistic cues from the old language. So the second part of the question about the hieroglyphic. Hieroglyphic has never been interpreted properly until Laird Scranton came along, and Hakim was basing his knowledge. He could read the hieroglyphic in the traditional way, but again, they're telling a mixed-up story, and just like the Nag Hammadi texts being translated by zealots instead of mystics, it just doesn't add up to the same thing. And there's some very subtle linguistic cues. So my PhD happens to be in linguistics, computational linguistics, but the idea that a turn of phrase, a way a preposition can be used, gender, verb, tense, changes the complete meaning, even if you can translate the nouns. It doesn't make it the same. So Hakim, at the heart of him, was a linguist. And that's where he's pulling the clues from. And he has the oral tradition that was never written down, right? And so if you think about how traditional Egyptology came along, Herodotus came from Greece, met a few, you know, local people, and they just told stories and then repeated them. And they're not necessarily connected to anything spiritual or anything of what the ancients were really about, particularly the pre-dynastic Egyptians, as I've mentioned before, that demarcation line where the patriarchal way of Egypt started, and that's almost the only part that people pay any attention to, as traditionalists would have it. So, no, there isn't anybody really continuing Hakim's work, and his legacy is embedded in the Pyramid Code, and that was my solution to the possibility that we're going to lose his knowledge. That's what the Pyramid Code is.
Right. Well, we're very happy that you have, talked about what you realized with him so that we at least have part of it. And do you think that it's because people just would not listen to him that he taught in the manner that he taught, but he wouldn't come out with information until he realized that you got it?
Yes, I mean, that he was a master, but he was also very humble, and he was not going to force information on anybody because he knew they didn't have the ears to hear it. But he used to say things to me like, you know, I'd say, oh, God, all this stuff from Egypt's all over the world and museums and you can't get to it. And they're wholesaling the artifacts out of the country and they're destroying this and that and the Christians, you know, chiseled away at everything. And he used to look at me and say, nothing can be lost, like a broken record. And I go, but what about this and what about this? And you hear about that container full of artifacts. They said they were fake and they're real and they're whole thing, little, and lining their pot. Nothing can be lost. It was, and then the other one that he used kept saying to me is like bubbles. You know, if I complain about bubbles, you know, bubbles that will burst. And that knowledge is knowledge. You can't hide it. Just like energy. Energy switches forms, but you can't lose it. And it took me years before I realized the wisdom of that. When he'd go, oh, bubbles, I think, oh, stop making fun of me, you know. This is a problem. I'm trying to tell you it's a problem. Anyway, so, you know,
funny.
He taught me a lot with just those ways. So I'm going to say nothing can be lost, and he's with us. And honest to God, in some ways, he's more here now than he was. When he first, I knew the second that he died, and it was interesting that the editor, I kept saying, have you put a team in yet? What we did, we laid the foundation. We put in all the interviews. We chose the parts we were going to use of Hakim. We had, you know, we had it all there, and then we brought Hakim in to certain specific spots. So I knew that the editor was working on that. I said, have you put Hakim in yet? Have you put Hakim in that? He says, okay, watch me. And he was taking the first clip of Hakim and dragging it into the Final Cut timeline. And then I got this, like this sense. And 15 minutes later, I got an email that he had passed away. 15 minutes ago, literally 15 minutes ago. So as he passed, he went into the timeline of the Pyramid Code, which I thought was just absolutely profound. But then he would come to me in the night and go, wake up, just in his voice, and put his face right in front of me, right? And then he'd start talking, right? And so it was very interesting. And then I went to this an evening with your guardian angel. And he was there was a woman who had been on the Egypt trip that invited me to come to this thing. And he actually lay down between us. And there was this thing where we would, instead of inviting the ascended people to come in, they were inviting us to cross over and meet them. And so, of course, it was Hakim waiting for me. And we danced, and he was talking in my ear and telling me all this stuff. And just to confirm, the woman who was the medium came around, and she told me what he said. Because she wanted to confirm. He wanted me to know that when he was talking to me from the other side, it really was him, and that's really what he was saying. And so, in other words, that's a long way around to say he's not gone.
And he's even
May I interject here? Hold all those thoughts and questions. We have Gloria Amendola holding on the switchboard, and she just wants to come in and give a couple of minutes of an update for the Rennes Le Chateau tour of France and the Mary Magdalene Bloodline tour mystery tour. I don't know if I got all those words right, but let me just take a little break right here, if you would please, Carmen. We'll be right back with Dr. Carmen Bolter and more questions from callers and the chat room. And make sure this is the right line here. Hello, Gloria. Is this you? 203. Well, hello. 203-942. Is this Gloria? Hello. Is this Gloria? No. Okay. Well, it looks like her number. Apparently, that was not. Oh, there she is. There she is. Sorry. Wrong. 203. There you go.
That's so funny. Can you hear me now?
Mercury is just beating me up. Okay. Gloria, you are on the air. Welcome.
Welcome. Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're just really excited about this this tour that you and Renee Barnett have put together. Just a quick preface for you. Renee was talking about her work on Bloodline the movie, and she had such a huge response from our audience wanting to know when she was going back that this tour actually organized itself.
It
and
did.
You are just going with it. So fill us in on the details, please.
Oh, yes, I definitely will, and thank you so much. It's funny because Renee and I have done tours before, and I've been to the Rennes-Le Chateau region 10 times myself through various trips, research, taking people, private tours. It's just an area that I love. But it's funny because Renee was getting the pull to go, and I was having dreams about Rennes, and we started to talk about that. And no sooner that we did, I think, Renee, I know, actually, I think you or someone, you provided the crystals that we used on one of our tours where we had people bury the crystals in the landscape.
Oh, that would have been Lavendar's Giza crystal.
Correct, correct. And, and so anyway, Renee all of a sudden was speaking, I think, with Lavendar again, and it just seemed like this was unfolding, and the energy was getting, it was just building. And then Magdalene came to me in a meditation, and she said that she wanted me to bring, in spirit, she said, she wanted me to bring a group of people there to do a sacred dance on the earth, which I have not done there in 10 times. I've done many things, but I haven't done that. And the geometries and the special life energy that's in that part of the world is extraordinary, and it's very, very connected to the Magdalene, very connected to Isis and Venus. It's an exceptional area, and I've traveled pretty extensively. So this tour just seemed to come about, and we're actually asking people to make a decision by next week, which is, I think, the Feast of the of the Virgin Mary, the Assumption Day. I think the Feast Day. It's on August 15th, anyway. And we're already almost full because people just are feeling the call to go there.
Well, I know it's going to be a life-changing tour for the people who are, as you said, called and compelled to go. So can you give us some it starts on October 2nd?
It does. It goes from October 2nd to October 8th. And anyone that wants an itinerary last minute here, they can email me and I can get them the necessary information, some of the logistics. But we're going to be going to Bugarash, which is very tied in, Mount Bugarash, to the apocalypse, they say, and to 2012. And we're going to go investigate that layer of the story there. And we're going to be delving into some of the information in Bloodline, but we're also going to work with the energy of the Earth because, as you know, the alignments in the calendar, the Maya calendar, and the Hopi prophecies are pretty strong from this corridor now between August and November. So I think there's just something pretty magical that's going to happen. So they can get more of the specific details and logistics if they email me personally.
Okay. Well, you want to give us your email address?
Sure, it's chalice4444@yahoo.com. That's chalice4444@yahoo.com. And they can also go to my website, and on the contact link, there is also a phone number if they prefer to get in touch with me that way. And my website is www.gloriaamendola.com, and that's AMENDOLA.
Okay, great. Great. Well, thank you so much for coming by, Gloria. And I know that I've talked to several people who are so excited, and they're definitely going with you. So you still have a few spots open.
We
do. They're going fast.
They are going very fast.
August 15th is the deadline for the decision
to be made. Because this trip organized itself, we had to pick a point to jump in because we're so close now in terms of planning everything logistically. So, yeah, that would be great. But thank you so much for letting us talk about it. It's one of our most favorite places in the world.
Well, I wish I could go in, but I will at another time.
Okay.
So thank you. Thank you so much, and give a big hug to Renee, and we will be looking for any future updates or information. Thanks so much, Gloria.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Wow. It's going to be great, folks. And as long as we just take a little pause here, we have just a little over 40 minutes left. We are going to continue with Dr. Carmen Bolter, and we also are going to hear from Maya and Rizin about some otherworldly experiences that they had at the Tetons during the Teton meetings. So let's go back to Dr. Carmen now, and then we will be back, let's say, in about 10 minutes for that story, and then back again. We're trying to fit a lot into one show, obviously. So, Purple Sage, are there any further questions from the chat room?
Well, just some that I had myself after watching the movie. I had some theories. In the movie, there were a lot of questions about why this was this and why it was that. And I have some theories, being the healer that I am. And I was wondering if any of these theories have actually come up in your conversations with the professionals who are dealing with this. The pyramids were obviously working with the stars, but I feel like they were also working with the earth elements that aid in bringing one closer to the stars, and that water wasn't important just for the obvious reasons, but also as a tool to use to work with all of the elements. Like the first pyramid at Abu, is that Rawash?
Yes.
Being fire, you had found some burnings at the bottom. It's an open pit. Abu Gharib being water. And with the quartz basins that were found, actually, my whole body started vibrating when I saw those quartz basins, and you were saying that nobody has given you a theory that satisfies you as to what they are. And
well,
body,
I wish I hadn't said that, because I've gotten an awful lot of people who are trying to theorize about it, and I definitely have something that I want to say about that.
And didn't,
you know, there was a lot of things that were implied in the Pyramid Code, and I knew it was going to be on national TV worldwide, so I didn't say everything I thought. I still kind of had my academic cover on, if you will. But you go ahead.
Well, out of all of the millions, my body says, I was there, I know, they were water basins, and that the hole in the side of them was where the water that flows under the pyramid was fed into the basins. Okay, so Saqqara being air with the temple of sound, when you listen to the harmonics that ring through the cavity of the pyramid, it gave me the same effect that the crystal and the Tibetan bowls give, which really take me out of there, and each chamber having its different harmonic resonance. And I also felt like when you discussed the different colors of the pyramids, the different colors were the different stones, correct?
Yes.
And each stone has its own harmonic resonance. And
yes,
that would be why that stone was chosen for that pyramid, and why that shape of the pyramid, because they're not all straight lines. Correct.
And does that leave Dashur to be the earth? Dashur is where the red pyramid, white pyramid, and black pyramid are. That's the earth.
Yep.
And that's also the triple goddess, the virgin white, the mother red, and the crone black. So, yeah, that's pretty good. I like that. And it's true. And I mean, and the other thing is that there's so much between the lines of the Pyramid Code that we actually did say most of that, but it tucked away and not as earth, air, fire, water in one piece. So I'm with you. I think that's very good. In terms of the quartz crystal bowls, I actually found a number of others behind the pyramid and off to the side, and I don't know if they'd been sitting there in plain sight the whole time for all the times I've been to Abu Ghraib, but they had different shapes and different kinds of holes. Okay, so there's about three different ways that these could have functioned, and I say probably all of them. There's a thing on the Coral Castle and how Leet Scallion would have used magnets in a circle. And then when I went back to Abu Ghraib, I noticed that in between each of those knobs along the top, there actually was a little depression that you could have put a round magnet in that functioned kind of like ball bearings in a magnetic sense. So it had something to do with the anti-gravity. That's for sure.
Cool.
The other thing is that the bowls, they actually, if you look at a satellite dish right now, like on your roof to get your TV, they have the bowl itself has that same shape. And so the hole could have been for positioning those. But I've always thought that the whole entirety of the band's teeth would have been the sound and light resonance with high-level initiates operating as human divining rods all at the same time when it was really cooking, and that these satellite dishes could have been positioned to amplify the energy between the sites. And the schist disc that you see in the Pyramid Code, that's that super fine green stone, would have sat, and you saw the animation where it was gone, whoom, 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 and it would have been the resonance frequency of the earth itself at the time. There was also a shield, and they would have stood in groups and been generating this energy all the while toning, all the while the water was running, okay? And so many people have had visions about those crystal bowls being suspended, but they're absolutely enormous, and they're solid crystal, and they're about 3 feet high. So they were very heavy indeed, but that the water would pour from one to the other, very much like Victor Schauburo talked about, if I got his name right, pours between the two and builds a charge of energy. So, you know, when you think that all of this could have been going on maybe 50,000 years ago, maybe 39,000 years ago, but a good long time ago, it stands to reason that we wouldn't have found all the bits and pieces, and we do have to put it back together. But I think that there was water pouring between them, yes. Water pouring in, yes. Magnets, yes, and frequencies being bounced between one, augmented and transmitted between one site and the other. Now, when they say, the traditional explanation is that they killed bulls and put the bulls in the hole, or in the basin, and then the blood would run out of the hole. Well, A, you would have stained it with blood, and mm-hmm. the white quartz looked red. B, a bull doesn't fit in something that size. It's only about, I don't know, 20 inches across. A bull's bigger than that. So, well, we already know that their explanations don't satisfy at all, but I do like how you put that together, so thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have another couple of questions, maybe one more question, and then I want to get to Maya and Rizine. So thanks so much, Purple Sage, and I will try to check back to the chat room one more time before the end of the show. So I will talk to you in a few, okay?
Okay.
Hey, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we are going to go to, let's see, we're going to talk to Ralph next. Hello, Ralph. You are on the air with Dr. Carmen Bolter.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's such a great show. Dr. Carmen, I had my original question you answered. However, I had another question, if you don't mind, which was about the Divine Feminine. And just recently I had a profound experience doing sort of a meditation of kind of connecting with that divine feminine, which I never thought I would, and it was kind of a game changer for me, so to speak, just that awareness. But without getting into a lot of details about that, I wondering if you had any ideas as to how we could impact more of the males to kind of let go of some of that patriarchal matrix kind of dumbed down, this, so to speak, that we're experiencing among the males, to bring them around as we go, as we kind of transition here, because I don't think that's going to be, many males are going to let go easily. So I was wondering if you had any ideas as to that we could use to maybe bring more males around to even visit the thought of the Divine Feminine. Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you. That's a very, very good question, and I appreciate it. And a few things come to mind. First of all, everyone's got the Sacred Masculine and the Sacred Feminine within them, and they've manifested in one or the other body. And so it's in there, and it's awakening. I see it all the time. I think that men are becoming smaller, it seems, and women are becoming bigger, it seems. And so I think that there's a natural feminization of the male, and I mean that in the, you know, the kindest way and the most balancing way. And what we're seeing in terms of Hollywood images is what I call gender benders, where there's a lot of images of jumping between the genders and gay men and men kissing each other and that sort of thing. And I think that that's rounding out this idea of the redneck, all-man kind of person. Now, a little bit of research is coming in here. When they examined the sex offenders' brains, they saw that they were completely right brain deficient, which meant that they had no feminine consciousness at all. And so the metaphor, having worked as a psychologist for 15 years, is that the man would go and steal the feminine energy, feminine consciousness from a little girl or from a woman, right? Uncontrollably need to have that. And it was because nature insists on a balance. And when you go back to the ancient Egyptians, so if their brain was devoid, then they'd have to have it somehow or another, so they'd go steal it, if you understand what I mean, in the form of rape or something, or sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And so in Egypt, there are several parallel masculine and feminine symbols. The papyrus is masculine, the feminine is lotus. Well, at the entrance to the Holy of Holies at the temple, you would see a papyrus and a lotus pillar. at the entrance to the temple, there is a cobra and a snake. So the cobra is the wings of the feminine, and the snake is the kundalini and the masculine. And so you'd see that, and then the jed and the teat, which is an ankh with the arms down, and then the spinal cord of Osiris. And so before you go to do any holy work, you'd see the wing disc, and you'd surrender the lower self to the higher self because you cannot walk into the temple without the balance. Okay? When you would pass to the other side, you'd have double masculine, double feminine, double masculine, double feminine, and they were the protectors, or else your soul couldn't navigate through the bardos. It absolutely required this, double of each. And so, and then even the birthing, that life comes out of the lotus, out of the fresh water. And so in Egyptian symbolism, down to the hands and feet, the sides of the brain, the scarab, all of it, everything I just mentioned, it all spells the absolute insistence on balance between the masculine and the feminine, or we have nothing. The very truth of that, I think, and the change in the energy is encouraging men to allow their feminine energy to come forth. Now, I have been interviewed where, you know, this real redneck guy who's got a cowboy hat on says, well, I'm sure not going to do that. It's like, yeah, right. It's true that there will be some resistance. And nobody can make anybody grow or be spiritual. The fact is that there is a bit of a division, that some people are coming along and some people aren't. It may be that expanding feminine consciousness is the ticket, inside a man is the ticket for them coming because of balance. Women have been balancing their checkbooks and working and doing masculine sorts of things. So we're not as out of balance because we've been living in a man's world. But without balance, we've got nothing. So I see men in the grocery store with their children. I see them developing relationships and being empowered by having an inner track with their children. We didn't have that when we were growing up, not in the same way. Children should be seen and not heard. The dad goes to work. The woman stays at home and cooks. So over time, I think that the blending of the genders is being shown in the mass media. And I think it's very, very essential for men not to be afraid. The only way we ever change is through modeling. So by one man being comfortable doing things, meditating and seeing things symbolically and all of that, paves the way for the next man to make that okay. But then it starts to be like the 100th monkey where it jumps into okayness. Well, men are wearing jewelry and makeup now and doing their hair, and you know what I'm saying, and wearing designer clothes and caring about how they look. That did not exist, you know, before. And now women are wearing running shoes and ponytails and no makeup, no jewelry, right? So we do have a reversal of the gender role right before our eyes now. So I think that the more of that we see, the more it makes it okay for other men. But the other thing is the younger generation, I don't think they're as uptight about it as our generation has been. Does that help?
Right.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much, Ralph. That was a good question. Thanks for calling. Okay. Dr. Carmen, we would like to hear from two of our Starseed community who went to the Tetons during the Teton meetings, which take place twice a year in January and July, when the Galactic Councils and federations actually physically come together inside Grand Teton Mountain and talk about projects and agendas. And Maya and Rizine were both there during that time, and they had some, let's say, otherworldly experiences. And if you would care to listen to their story, we will be back with Dr. Carmen Bolter after we hear from Maya and Rizine. So, okay, they're both on the same line. That's really good. Okay, let me get this turned on here. Hello, ladies. Welcome, and thank you so much for calling. We have on the air with us now Maya and Rizine, and would you just tell us about your trip to the Tetons and how it was different this time than other times you've been there. Hello. Your microphone is on. Is your phone on mute? You might want to check that.
It was on mute. Hi, this is Maya. How are you?
Good, Maya. Thanks for calling. And Rizine, you there too?
Hi, Ariel. This is Rizine.
Hello. Well, thanks for calling. So, would you just tell us the story that you wrote to me?
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and start. This is Maya, and we have gone to the Tetons a dozen times every summer the last couple of years and had amazing experiences. However, we've never gone up during the period of time for the Teton meeting, whether, you know, coincidental, I'm sure there was a reason, but we went purposefully this summer during the Teton meeting. And the moment that we hit the pass, we're on the west side of the Tetons, and we were crossing over to go near the Jenny Lake area. And the moment that we hit the pass, everything felt different. It actually didn't even look like it was real. And we started, you know, joking about it and saying, you know, if I didn't know better, it looked like the whole mountains are cloaked and there's just a cardboard version of the mountains that look there to fool the rest of us into believing that the mountains are really here. And then our day just continued to get weirder and weirder from then. When we arrived at Jenny Lake, they hadn't told or announced ahead of time, but all of the trails back into the canyon were closed. They were warning people to stay away because of grizzly bear sightings. And even when we went to our normal places, where we are very familiar with the trails and very familiar with the area, we didn't even feel inclined to go there. We went to a different area this time. And I'm going to let Rizine tell you how it felt to be in a different side of the lake than we normally were.
Hi, this is Rizine. The side we usually go to is very welcoming. It was closed, so we couldn't go to that side on the trail. So we decided to go the other direction, and it was very interesting. It was a little bit, it was just not as welcoming. It was very, very interesting because there was ships all over. We could see them. And definitely different representations of numerous beings. And one in particular, he wasn't very welcoming. He wasn't very nice, and he was a little bit cold.
If I can interject, he reminded us of, say, a bouncer at a club. He was there for security, and he wasn't certain that we were on the guest list.
Absolutely, that's a great description. Anyway, you know, and it took a little bit of time for him to really, I could feel that he was scanning us. And as soon as he recognized our energy, he really opened up. And then a lot of other beings came. He was the one that really talked to us the most. And he allowed us to go on the ships and explore a little bit. It was
phenomenal.
He explained things to us about how important the meetings are, how important his role is, as my version, my understanding of what he was conveying is like a sentinel, a security guard, very committed to his mission and his role to protect the area. And he did confirm for us that there was a level of cloaking, like a force field, that would keep out any energy that wasn't welcome or that was negative or, you know, had malice or was trying to, I think you call it the trickster energy.
Mm-hmm.
He was never friendly. He didn't think I was funny. He didn't like my jokes. But he did, which I'm not used to. I'm used to them appreciating, you know, some humor and interaction, and he did not. He was very stoic, but he did share a little bit of information with us, and about 20 minutes later, he said, okay, your window's closed, and you should get on down the trail.
Wow. Can you describe him?
You know, this is Maya. For me, my gifts and sensitivities, I have a difficulty right now being able to see with my physical eye. I have a tendency more to feel or to see with my third eye. And he was very large. Another word that would come to mind to maybe describe him is a centurion of some kind. And he was huge. And that's all that I can tell you is really how it felt to me. Huge, very powerful, very committed. And I'll let Raisin tell you what she was actually able to pick up. It was difficult because in the seeing of what he looked like, we were more, I'm going to say this word, we were more seduced by the ships because there were dozens and dozens ahead of us that were apparently, you know, sort of parked in this clearing. And I could ramble about this. It's so hard to try to tell you all that we want to tell you in a short, you know, 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. So there was actually ships on the ground.
Yes, there was. This
wow.
is rising. There was ships all over. His energy, you know, it was harder for me to really see what he was like because I was really focused on all the ships. And the ships were on the ground. They were in the air. They were all over. But you can clearly see all of them surrounding the whole area of the Tetons. And we knew exactly where the meeting was at. Like I said earlier, the trails were all closed, which we've never been up there before with the trails closed like they were this time. They've never been like that before. His energy was, he was very, very, it was a strong energy. He was really tall, kind of a warrior energy, a protector. And it was very, very interesting because he also told us that a lot of the beings stay up there year-round and protect that area. But at that particular time, it's almost like they all come in to protect because it's such a sacred place and a sacred time that they can't allow anyone to sneak past and get in that shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
This is
wow.
Sierra, ladies. What is it you said it, you referenced it two or three times that they told you some information. Can you verbalize what it was that they were teaching you when you were on ship?
They were, yes, I can. They were trying to explain to us and convey to us that as humans, we have an idea that we are, it's almost like we're egocentric in thinking that we are the everything. And he was trying to convey that a lot of the things that are going on are going to happen whether or not we purposefully cooperate. There was a moment where I was thinking, I didn't actually verbalize it, but I was thinking, am I really that insignificant? And he actually picked up on my thought and said, well, it's not that you're insignificant. It's that you need to understand that everything that's going on here is so much bigger than you could possibly comprehend. The magnitude, how far it reaches. And, you know, hey, I'm a human. I'll readily admit that. But, he was trying to explain that to us and to they aligned our energies with the energies of the ship. So there was an energetic exchange where we were able to feel, there was even a DNA activation. And I don't know, terminology-wise, I don't know how else to explain it other than they literally let us stand there and merge and just do an energetic exchange. And when we left there, my vibration was heightened to the point where I was seeing more with my physical eyes than I normally do. I'm trying to recall, and I'll do this while Rising takes a turn. I'm trying to recall specifics that he shared with us because on some level it was a deep knowing and remembering that I'm not actually sure I can verbalize, but I'm going to try while she takes a turn. You know, it was really interesting because one of the main messages was we're living in an illusion. And it's really time for us to all take our power back and grab these pieces that are from other areas and the aspects of us that are other beings and bring that back and really step out of the illusion that we all live in the physical realm because it's way bigger than what we think. I mean, we're living in this physical world and it's the illusion. And it was really a wake-up call as to, you know, get your stuff ready and get yourself together and prepare because we're coming. And more people are going to see us and they're going to have to acknowledge us. And we all already know that they're right here now assisting us. And it's about raising our frequencies and keeping our vibrations up really, really high so that we're ready and we can assist others that
they're not going to be ready. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that don't believe at all, and we don't have much more time left. I mean, time to prepare and get ready is right now, because the illusion, the veil is going to drop, and they're already here, and more people are going to see them. And it was very, very interesting to realize that we really are kind of insignificant. It was like reminding yourself that you might be the ant who's working in an ant hill, and there might be a human who's above your heel, and then you're part of a community park that's inside of a city, that's inside of a state and a country, and it just keeps getting bigger from there. So,
And that, but yet we all have the potential to become ascended masters if we keep at it long enough. It will eventually evolve to that point. So we have as much significance as a little baby.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was interesting, though, that a lot of people aren't really stepping into that. And his message was more so, you know, just step into it and do it and stop waiting and put yourself out there and be who you're supposed to be and assist others and speak your truth.
You're right, because the door has been open for some time, and it's now time for action. And, you know, if you are awake, it's time to get up on the horse and ride. And if you're not awake, there's not much anybody can do about it.
You know, Ariel, that's exactly what he was conveying to us. And it actually worked, because we're obviously starting to come out of our hiding shell. We've been sitting over here in our area trying to hide in a cave and not step out and speak up, because we didn't want other people to judge us or to, you know, hey, that's weird, that's really out there. And we're getting to the point where, hey, we're ready to start speaking up and share with you that there's amazing things going on, and we can tap into these benevolent beings. We can start dispelling the idea that everything that's extraterrestrial or alien has some, you know, is malicious and they're here to hurt us. Popular media would tell you that the alien invasion is coming and we're all going to die. And we've got to stand up and say, no, these are high vibrational, loving beings who are here to help us, and we can work in a collaboration and a cooperation with them.
Right, right. Well, you know, that's all part of what Dr. Carmen was talking about, because the misdirection of using fear and intimidation and all that part of Hollywood, part of the third dimension, you know, fight, you know, kill the aliens. That's all part of a patriarchal society that is crumbling and falling apart. Wouldn't you say, Dr. Carmen? Your mic's still on.
It's definitely falling apart, and they're kicking and screaming on their way out the door.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they have to go, you know. Time's up. Contract's over.
Right.
So, Maya and Rising, do you have more to the story, or is that what you had to say?
You know what, Ariel, we could talk for a long time and go into greater detail about the things that we've experienced. But for today, that's pretty good. I wanted to let you know that we did start blogging about it. It's at starseedblog.com, and we are going to step up and do our part to start sharing with everybody else, start stepping into our power and, you know, fulfilling our roles as starseeds. So if you want to check us out, we're at starseedblog.com.
That's great. I meant to mention that in the intro, and I failed to, so forgive me for that. But, yes, starseedblog.com. You can meet and interact and read, and can they post comments to your blogs?
Yeah, and we actually would really even enjoy sharing other people's stories as well. It doesn't have to be the Rising and Maya show.
Okay.
And
great.
Thank you,
well,
Dr.
Thank
Carmen.
You.
It's been great listening to you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed listening to you, too.
Okay. Thanks, ladies. Bye-bye. Well, and thank you, Dr. Carmen, for sharing the stage Because I know that, I mean, they've been holding that story since the beginning of July, and I just really, really enjoy the fact that they were willing to step up and share it because the message is so important.
Sure.
This is Levendar, and Dr. Carmen, you have a trip coming up in, I believe, 11-11 into Egypt. Would you like to talk about it and tell the audience about this trip?
Yep, it's November 7th to 21st. They can access the full itinerary on pyramidcode.com under the Trips tab. And on 11-11-11 at 1-11, we get in there at 1 o'clock, we'll be inside the Great Pyramid for a private meditation with just our group, and that is for sure an ascension portal. The trip takes you to as many places that you see in the Pyramid Code as I'm allowed to bring you to. And, you know, we'll be doing a sunset horse and camel ride on the desert and a dancing horse party and a barbecue with the Bedouins. And then it's five-star all the way with a four-night cruise. And it's available for registration now. So if anybody's interested, they can just email me and I can give them further details and chat to them about it. So, yes, it's not the group just opened about 2 weeks ago, and so there's room left in it.
Oh, good. Thank you so much. And I really appreciate you taking the time to share with our audience your information, because like I had said to you earlier in an email, we pretty well have a Starseed Awake group that just wants to know more and more how they can be more aligned to their work and to the planet. And I think you've given some indications of your work, and that inspires others to do their work.
Yes, I'm very inspired, too, to hear that you're so well organized. And I did go on your website and look at those pictures you were referring to, and they're uncanny, and I see what you mean about the changing grid there inside the Great Pyramid. Very good.
Yeah.
Well, we have just a few minutes left, so, Dr. Carmen, is there any points that you would like to hit that we have not yet?
Well, just with interactiveview.com, there is a sign-up sheet if you want to subscribe, if anybody's interested. And I'm pretty certain from your audience there may be people that could have something they want to teach as well. And so if anybody wants to contact me about that and enter into a dialogue, I should be ready in about a month to launch it. And prior to that, I am working with the Prophets Conference and Evolver to do a Pyramid Code course online, which is similar to the structure I've talked about. So if anybody's interested in either of those, they can contact me, and it's all linked up on my website.
Well, that would be great. You know, it could be an outlet, because we do have a lot of people with great abilities, and they do need to have a place, an outlet for those. So it could
absolutely
be...
Absolutely, and the, yeah, stepping outside of the educational system is a very exciting venture indeed, and a lot of people were damaged by traditional school, and there's been no place for these cross-referencing of disciplines and going off-planet and telling real stories. But like I said to the gentleman inquiring about feminine consciousness in men, everything changes through modeling. And so if there's enough people telling stories about, just like what I just heard with the ship and the Arcturian and protection and all of that, I mean, that's the essence of disclosure. If the government is not going to disclose, and we've got to remember that the government is largely run by those, you know, beings that kept it all patriarchal, then someone else has to do it. And so I think we're in a very good position to be collaborating now.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Well, I'll tell you, we only have like 2 minutes left, and I am just so thrilled that you have had the time to come and spend with us and our audience, who is a very awake and many, many advanced starseed. I know they're going to check out your site, interactive-u.com, and
right,
the pyramidcode.com, and the pyramid code.
Pyramid.
Yeah.
The
website
pyramidcode.com.
pyramidcode.com.
And the documentary is The Pyramid Code, is the documentary, and the website is www.pyramidcode.com.
Great, and there's contact
information. Which is interactive now, too. There's lots of embedded videos and photo galleries, and I'm continuing to add to it. So.
And is there actually a web page up for that at this time? Or is
for Interactive
too, you know,
View?
Yes.
No, Interactive View has got a page that just says welcome, and it's got the sign-up sheet. So when I'm ready to launch it whole, If you've got your name and email there, then you'll get the information as soon as I launch. So it's a good idea to sign up, and you can also sign up on Pyramid Code through my Facebook page or through Pyramid Code page. And so you can sign up. And I just noticed that the gals that went to the Tetons just registered to follow me on Twitter. So we're all connected.
Excellent. Excellent. Aren't we all? Thank you so much.
Well, I hope to hear from you again. And both two of you said, Ariel and Lavendar said they wanted to talk again, so I hope that happens.
Yes, we definitely will. We would love to have you back because I know that you have only scratched the surface of what you know. So
sure, and as more people watch the series, they'll have more questions, and we can all just keep on discussing.
That'll be great. Well, Lavendar, Tammy, Sierra, Purple Sage, we are all so grateful that you were with us. Dr. Carmen Bolter, everyone from pyramidcode.com. Join us next week, Tuesday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and we look forward to hearing from you between now and then. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Good night.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Carmen Bolter.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.